Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Hey, I thought I would talk about a simile of the Buddha. Buddha has so many wonderful similes, images for different things, and this is one way he has of describing mindfulness. This has to do with the It's the simile of the beauty queen. People get word in a village that the most beautiful woman in the region is going to put on a performance of singing and dancing. Throngs of people show up to listen to this. But one person who represents the meditator, represents you, is given the task that while this performance is going on, he has to walk between the audience and the performer. And he has to walk with a vat of oil balanced on his head, filled to the brim. And as he walks, a man with a sword follows him. And if he spills one drop from the vat, the man with the sword's going to cut off his head. So this is the way it's kind of done from a masculine point of view, but you get the idea. The way the Buddha pictured the task of that we all face in remaining mindful. It's hard to picture exactly what this would have looked like at the time of the Buddha. I imagine they probably did not have neatly defined stages and a nice aisle between the audience and the stage in those days. Probably everybody just sat on the ground or just stood up cheering, waving their hands. So it's probably very precarious to try to walk between the audience and the dancing woman. The idea of carrying a vat on the top of your head is kind of foreign to us, but in many parts of the world, this is something people learn to do. People in Burma often carry very heavy loads, especially women, carry heavy loads on their head, and they usually wrap a cloth around their head to help balance it, but they can carry flat objects or balls and things on their head. It's probably a good way of carrying heavy loads because I've seen people do that and they always have such good posture. Whereas people that, you know, the Western way is to carry it like this. You if you do that long enough, your posture will suffer. But anyway, this simile represents mindfulness and the task of mindfulness. So I've been talking about mindfulness in a number of talks here. And I point out that mindfulness, the basic meaning of mindfulness for the Buddha is to remember what your task is, to remember what you're doing right now. This differs quite a bit from how most people, most Western teachers, describe mindfulness. But mindfulness is a regulatory function. So in this case, the person's task is to successfully carry this vat of oil on his head and not spill a drop. Now, the swordsman represents the implications of not being mindful. And it seems awfully extreme to get your head cut off, but for the Buddha, mindfulness is such a basic foundation of practice. And if we do not practice and practice mindfulness successfully, the implications are a matter of life and death. They are a matter of continued existence through samsara, through the ages. If we're successful in our mindfulness, we can avoid all of the future pain of samsara. So the mindfulness is regulating your behavior, and the challenge is not to be distracted. So you're going to be distracted by the beautiful dancing woman. You're also going to be distracted by the audience, their movements. It might be easy to trip over somebody's foot. And so this is our task in mindfulness. We're always dealing with distraction, but mindfulness is the monitoring function. It has to notice when we're beginning to be distracted and then bring us back to our task at hand, whatever that task at hand is. The distractions for us are actually generally the five hindrances, which I've talked about in here. So this is kind of a standard list of that you can use as a checklist. The first one is lust or sensual passion. The other one, the next one is ill will, which can include anger, harsh feelings that you may be entertaining in your mind. The next one is sloth and torpor. It's the third one, sleepiness or just dullness of mind. And then restlessness and remorse that you may be feeling. And then finally doubt in the practice, in the efficacy of the path, in your own ability to practice. So these are all of the distractions we hold at bay. The Buddha also has another simile for mindfulness, which is quite simple. And this is a cowherder. A cowherder is bringing the cow from the field back into the barn in the evening. And he has to be able to control the cow so that the cow doesn't wander off the road and wander into people's farmers' fields and things. So he has a stick in his hand. And every time the cow starts to wander off, he whacks the cow with the stick to remind him to get back on the road. And so this requires mindfulness. If he loses his mindfulness, if he gets distracted in his thoughts or stubs his toe on something and tends to his toe, the cow is immediately going to go off the road into the farmer's fields. So this is, again, the regulatory function of mindfulness, to keep on task. This time you're keeping the cow on task rather than yourself. Kind of an extension of that, you can imagine a young mother taking care of a toddler, and maybe going to a shopping mall or something with the toddler. You'll see that the mother will be extremely mindful, if she's a good mother, because there's so many ways that the toddler can get into mischief or injure himself or get lost. So wherever the toddler goes, the mother will be right there, attending every movement. It's a very good example that you can observe of mindfulness. As soon as the toddler goes over here, goes over to, display of sunglasses or something, the mother is there to bring the toddler back. As soon as the toddler starts heading for the escalator, the mother brings the toddler back. If the mother is lucky, they will have kind of a penned-in area at the mall. Sometimes you find this in doctor's offices and things, where it's just full of toys for kids. And there's a lot of kids there, and it's hard for the kids to escape. There's only one entrance. And, of course, the toys are all harmless. All the furniture has rounded edges. Things are made out of plastic. So there's not much that the kid can do to harm themselves. In that case, the mother doesn't really have to have a lot of work. Mindfulness is quite easy. The mother will sit there and watch the kid play, but there's really not much danger. But once the kid heads for the exit, the mother will be very attentive, will have to follow the kid. So this is an example of the kid being distracted from playing in this area, sees something out there, somebody has their dog with them or something, and the kid just immediately heads out. So the mother has to follow the kid, but remain very attentive. So this is kind of a simile for our practice when we do get distracted in our practice. I've been advocating that the practice is not complete if you simply practice by focusing on one thing in your meditation. So a lot of people, they learn to focus on the breath. That is where their mind remains. And the task that they have to be mindful about is keeping the mind with the breath. And as soon as the mind is distracted and goes somewhere other than the breath, the mindfulness knows that, brings the breath, the mind back to the breath. But this way of practicing is actually very limited, because the purpose of Buddhist meditation is to observe and examine, to learn the elements of our experience, to learn our own minds, to learn reality or how we perceive reality, and learn how our experience is actually put together. And there are many, many aspects of our experience. And our meditation should be allowed to range over all of these aspects. What we can say about the breath is that it is a good home base. It's easy to follow the breath. Once we've trained ourselves to follow the breath. So it's like having your kid in the contained area that's intended for kids. It's a home base. You can relax. The mindfulness is not a lot of work. And it's easy to stay on task, which is to keep the kid safe. So for us, our task may be simply to keep the mind with the breath. But when distractions arise, we can either treat them as distractions and bring the mind back to the breath. But often distractions have a lot to teach us. So say there's restlessness that arises. Restlessness keeps you over and over again. You keep being pulled away from the breath because of this ongoing restlessness. You just, all these other thoughts keep bubbling up. It's a distraction only if you decide to treat it as a distraction. You can also look at the restlessness as an opportunity. So rather than following the breath, you follow the restlessness. You put the mind right on the restlessness. Study restlessness. Breath is fascinating. Restlessness is fascinating. This is like allowing your kid to go out the gate, the kiddie area, and explore something out there in the world. You want the kid at some point to start doing that. The kid needs to learn about the world. It needs to learn about the dangers of the world. And you need to learn about the world and the dangers of the world, what's happening in your own experience. So as long as you choose deliberately to follow the restlessness, keep your mind with the restlessness, make that the object of your mindfulness, of your meditation, as long as you have made that choice, it is not a distraction. It's part of your mindfulness. Now your job is to stay with the restlessness. And it works with anything that arises. You can keep the mind with your anger. Maybe anger just keeps boiling up. You just have something going on in your life. You're mad at somebody. That anger keeps reappearing. Make the anger the object of your mindfulness. Now your mindfulness is going to have more work to do. It's not in the safe area of the breath. You're moving away from your home base when you follow anger or restlessness or anything else that's arising. You may hear sounds and you may just want to be with the sounds and observe the witness to the sounds as along with observing the sounds. Fascinating part of our experience. It doesn't really matter what you choose to focus on. And it's highly recommended that you follow these different tracks. You want to learn all about your experiential world, not just the breath. The problem is it's more challenging. When you're in your home base, it's relatively easy to stay with your object, to maintain mindfulness, to also experience the stillness that comes with maintaining mindfulness. As soon as you move away from your home base, you're much more liable to distraction. So you're trying to look at your anger, for instance. Suddenly the mind can just be full with all kinds of ideas, proliferation of thoughts and feelings and things. And you're no longer meditating. You're just back in the normal world. So this is the danger. So typically what we do in Vipassana practice is we remember what our home base is. If the mind starts spinning out of control as we're looking at anger or looking at restlessness or whatever, or sounds of birds, if our mind starts to spin out of control, then we want to return to our home base, at least for a moment, because we can stabilize the mind there. And then we can allow it to go out and explore something else. So this is very common, and I think this is why the Buddha taught Anapanasati, the mindfulness of in and out breathing. In addition to the Satipatthana, which mentions breathing, but only as one as many practices, the logic of the Anapanasati Sutta, the discourse on the mindfulness of in and out breathing, is that we maintain a home base, that we always keep track of our breath. At the same time, we're looking at other things. So this is a very effective way of keeping the mind stable. With more and more skill, you depend less and less on the breath as you begin to explore other things in the body. As a Zen meditator, I learned rather than using the breath as the home base, use the posture as a home base. It's a wonderful home base. One is the posture when you're sitting like this. It reminds you of the Buddha. Almost every Buddha statue is sitting in meditation, sitting cross-legged. Posture is very present. But it's very, very simple. It's simpler than the breath, and so you don't hang onto it as tightly as the breath. It allows the mind to flow to other things quite fluidly. So this is what we want to do in our meditation practice: be able to move from one place to another, from one kind of object to another. Because ultimately, we want to understand it all. So when we do choose a meditation object and a new meditation object, Establishment of Mindfulness Sutta gives us four kinds of objects. One are objects having to do with the body, including the breath, but other aspects of the body, with feelings, with the mind itself, and then what's called mindfulness of phenomena, or observation, actually a phenomena, or examination of phenomena, which are phenomena like suffering and craving and things that are mentioned in the Dhamma. And much of the Dhamma is really a map to your experiential world. And so this fourth category is making use of that map of the Dhamma. But one thing is that for any object you pick, the idea is to not get caught up in the object. So they talk, when you look at a feeling, like feelings are basically preferences, things you like and don't like. So when a feeling arises, you examine the feeling in the feeling. This is the expression. You examine the body in the body, the mind in the mind, which, as I understand it, and I think everybody interprets this as saying, you know, when we have a tendency for anything we look at, to look at our, not the thing itself, but all of the ideas and attitudes and reactions that we wrap around things, but look at the thing itself. And so this is very important in order to not let the mind spin out of control, to be totally distracted. So when we look at something like anger, you look at the anger in the anger. You don't get wrapped up in all of the story behind the anger and all of the plans, what you're going to do with the anger. Tell somebody off or seek revenge or don't get caught. But anger as an experience in itself. What does the anger feel like? How does it feel in the body? What is the texture it gives to the mind, mm-hmm. rather than the content of the anger? Mm-hmm. So this is important. This is how we keep from spinning out of control, so that we can just pick something and start to examine it and maintain our mindfulness, which means give ourselves the task for now is to examine my anger and not be distracted from that task. If I start to spin out of control, then I'll back up and go back to the breath till I can maintain my stability. But then the anger is worth looking at.